It's Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, daily life might be slowly getting back to a normal, but what do you remember about those early days of the pandemic? We'll take your thoughts and memories ahead. First, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down several major rulings over the past few days. Those include shutting down the latest challenge to the Affordable Care Act and ruling in favor of a Catholic adoption agency that refused to work with same-sex couples. And in another decision released today, the court ruled against the NCAA and opened the door for college athletes to receive certain types of compensation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts about the recent Supreme Court rulings? What questions do you have about their effect or what we could see next? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of political science specializing in public law, judicial process, and American politics. He's at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Charlie, thanks for being back with us.
Thanks for having me, Keeley.
Let's start with the Affordable Care Act, one of the most closely watched cases, a challenge from Texas and other states to the ACA. And they were claiming that because Congress zeroed out the penalty, the tax for not having insurance, that that tax and then the whole law became unconstitutional. What did the court say here?
So the court actually didn't get to the merits of the case. They didn't really get to the fundamental questions because they made their determination based upon a doctrine called standing. Now, standing has to do with whether or not you have a case or controversy to bring to the court. And that's actually spelled out in Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. But the court has created its own rules and regulations about who can come to the court and who can't and who actually has a case or a controversy. And when it comes to standing, the most important thing is are you injured? Do you have an injury in fact? And can you trace that injury to the unconstitutional or unlawful conduct? And then the last element is, well, can the court actually do anything? Can they redress the problem that you have? And, you know, this we often call this a threshold issue. So can you actually cross the threshold of the court and have your case heard? And in this case, the court basically slammed the door in the litigant's face saying, you don't have standing because you weren't really injured. And you can't really trace that injury to anything the court has done. So how does that relate to the basic question that they were asking? Well, they were saying that they zeroed out this penalty. And the penalty in a previous case, the court determined was a tax. And that's something that Congress could do. And that made the ACA Obamacare constitutional. And so those who wanted to see the repeal of Obamacare argued, well, if there's no penalty, then there's no tax. And hence, there can't be any issue. But what the court said, what Justice Breyer said in his opinion was, well, here's the problem. How can you be injured if they won't enforce the tax if you don't get health care? There won't be any injury. And even if you claim that there is, what are we supposed to do about it? They're never going to enforce it in the first place. So they sort of handed them their hat and said, you can leave the court now because we're not even going to get to the rest of your arguments because you shouldn't even be here. And the interesting thing is they dismissed both the states as plaintiffs, and a pair of individuals who brought the case. They shooed everybody out the door as quickly as possible. And I would argue that it's as much legal as it is political, because sometimes we forget that the justices read the newspapers and they go on the internet and they see sort of what the scuttlebutt is about these kinds of issues. And I think that they believed in part that there was going to be some political blowback if they did real damage to this particular act.
And that ruling was a 7-2 ruling, and dissenting opinion really took aim at the fact that they did just say, you don't have a case to bring to us right now, and didn't deal with the merits of the case.
Yeah, remember that dissenters can, because there's no real legal value to what they're writing in the sense of it doesn't serve as precedent, they can, you know, they can sort of throw a little legal tantrum if they want to. And so what you're really seeing here is a bit of sour grapes from the dissenters because they see the court as rescuing a poorly constructed bill. Remember, the ACA is hundreds of pages long, and it was the result of compromise, which often makes for some ugly legislation, right? There are a couple of things you don't ever want to see made, and that's sausage and laws. And this is an ugly mess of a piece of legislation. And the argument that's coming from the dissenters is, you've rescued this bill twice before, you're rescuing it a third time, when really it can't stand on its own because there are so many fatal flaws. And the argument is you're using this kind of get out of jail free card with standing to not get to the merits and not allow a real full argument about why this is an improper piece of legislation from Congress.
So if this case was decided based on a lack of standing, does that mean the door is still open for other challenges that could have legal standing?
Yeah, but the door is cracked open just a sliver. That's the real problem here, is that they're, you know, they keep slamming the door on people and you're running out of arguments that you can make. And when I said it was political, certainly the justices, and we know this through a lot of really good research, that the justices are ideological and they will make arguments based upon the law. But just like any other human being, we have our own political and ideological agenda. And as a result, you know, they often want to lean in a particular direction, but they're also not foolish. I mean, this was an unpopular law up until about 2018. And since that time, most polls have shown that 50% or more of the public actually supports this piece of legislation.
I think we have taken that open door metaphor about as far as we can go on the ACA. Charlie Jacobs is a political science professor at St. Norbert College, and we're talking about decisions that have come down from the U.S. Supreme Court. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Let's talk about another case, which is Fulton versus Philadelphia. And that's been getting attention because of what it could mean or could have meant for LGBTQ rights and religious liberty. What was the decision here?
So this one is a little complicated, and I've got to sort of do a little backstory about a case that was decided in 1990 called Oregon versus Smith, which, you know, three decades ago kind of rocked the world in our understanding of the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. And in that particular case, what the court determined was that if a law is neutrally drawn or neutrally authored and is generally applicable to everyone, then as long as it doesn't create a real substantive burden on your religious freedom, the law is going to stand. Well, what does that mean? That means that, you know, if there is some law that is passed and there's no intent to discriminate against a religion per se, and it hurts or helps individuals in religious traditions equally, then there's nothing wrong with the law, even if it has some sort of incidental burden on your religion. So here's a sort of a flippant kind of example. But, you know, every state and the federal government has a murder statute. You can't murder people. If my religious tradition says that I'm supposed to take a follower and throw them into a burbling volcano as a sacrifice, well, that violates the murder statute, which wasn't aimed at inhibiting this religious tradition. It was intended for a moral and social purpose that has an incidental burden on a particular religious tradition. And so in that case, they laid out that kind of understanding of the First Amendment. But the problem is that you still have burdens on religions. And that's what was happening in the Fulton case. This was a city ordinance that required, if you were going to participate in the placement of foster children, you couldn't discriminate. In this case, Catholic Social Services wasn't supposed to be discriminating against same-sex couples who might want to foster a child. And as a result, they claimed that this was more than just an incidental burden, and they wanted this particular case overturned. Now, that might seem like a bit of an arcane argument, but it's actually kind of a big deal because this has given states, local, and the federal government a lot of freedom to have these generally drawn pieces of law. And it really creates problems for religious institutions in meeting their obligations and their faith requirements. And so that's what was at stake here. And what we really see was, to use sort of a biblical kind of reference, a Solomonic kind of splitting of the baby here. Because while they upheld Catholic Services' free exercise rights, they did not do away with this Smith standard. And so we have old doctrine, but at least an opening for these religious institutions to avoid these kinds of commands from state and local governments to behave in a particular way that undermines their religious traditions.
Mm-hmm. We've got Lena in Stevens Point who wants to join in on this part of the conversation. Hey, Lena.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about this legislation. So I identify with the LGBTQ community. I, of course, stand completely 100% opposed to discriminating against who can adopt based on the sex of the couple that wants to adopt. However, I'm also a very firm believer in keeping church and state separated. And so I'm wondering how to kind of reconcile those two things of being completely opposed to the concept of the ruling, however, kind of agreeing with the Supreme Court or government in general not being able to kind of make those decisions according to law. So that's my question, something I'm curious about. Thanks.
Lena, thanks for bringing this up. And Charlie, how do you respond to Lena on that front?
So it's a great question, Lena. And, really, when we talk about religious freedom in the United States, there are sort of two sides of the same coin, the Establishment Clause, and that's the church-state issue that she's referencing, and then the Free Exercise Clause. So on the one hand, you want to make sure that there's a separation between church and state, but sometimes that actually can interfere with your ability to freely exercise. And so, I think one of the things that Justice Roberts was trying to get across here is that the fundamental issue that the city of Philadelphia was bringing up is they wanted to stop discrimination. And in this case, discrimination against the LGBTQ community. And as a result, they wanted to limit the ability of Catholic social services from conducting that kind of discrimination. But the church is saying, no, that's our mission as an organization to support marriage between a man and a woman. And what Roberts sort of came to the conclusion of is, well, how is the LGBTQ community getting harmed? Because it's not as though you couldn't foster a child if you were part of that community, because other non-Catholic social services organizations were placing kids in those homes. And so they could still take the opportunity. It's just that one of the partnering organizations with the city wasn't doing it. And Roberts's argument was, well, so allow them an exemption to not have the placement there and allow other organizations to make those placements on behalf of the city. So I think that kind of gets to Lena's point about this and trying to understand how you can balance the traditions of a religion as well as the needs of a community to be non-discriminatory.
We are talking with Charlie Jacobs, political science professor at St. Norbert College. We're talking about recent rulings from the Supreme Court. We'll also get to pressure on the court's oldest justice, Stephen Breyer. Some people want him to retire soon, and we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the recent rulings of the court? Are you curious why justices ruled one way or the other? What do you think about Justice Breyer? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. This conversation continues ahead on Central Time. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer is the oldest member of the court, and he's been under pressure from some Democrats in Congress to retire before next year's midterm elections. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said last week that a Republican Senate would not confirm a Biden nominee to the court in the 2024 election year. We're talking about it here on Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Charlie Jacobs is our guest. He's a political science professor at St. Norbert College, and there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Give us your questions, your thoughts about the cases that you've seen the Supreme Court rule on at 800-642-1234. Charlie, we got to get into the makeup of the Supreme Court and the politics around it, because Justice Stephen Breyer is a liberal justice. He's 82, and some Democrats in Congress say he has to retire before the midterm election year. What is the question he faces right now?
Well, the question he faces is whether or not, delaying at least for one more term is going to have a distinct impact on the makeup of the court. So, he could serve through 21-22 and still give, enough time during the summer for the confirmation of his replacement. Now, I suppose the Republicans could make some argument that they should delay because now it's a midterm election year. they're kind of running out of arguments for why every appointment to the United States Supreme Court creates some sort of exception. But there would be plenty of time. And the reason I argue that is Amy Coney Barrett's nomination and confirmation was very rapid. And it's obvious that the Senate, if pressed, can do it quickly. So I'm not sure whether or not Breyer has to do it this year. He could probably survive one more term on the court and not do damage in the way that the progressives and the liberals believe. But at the same time, sooner is probably better than later. One never knows exactly what kind of circumstances might come up. We've seen in the past somebody like Jim Jeffords from New Hampshire who switched parties. That could possibly happen and switch control of the Senate over to the Republicans. So there are all sorts of things that could happen that might make him lean towards retirement. But, you know, this is one of those positions that it's a once in a lifetime. And it may be that Breyer wants to have one more opportunity to put his stamp on a couple of cases.
Hmm. And we heard from Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who, you know, points to the fact that he held off on a seat that was eventually filled by Gorsuch as one of his, you know, shining accomplishments, that McConnell said they wouldn't fill the seat. Is this the kind of political seesaw, the atmosphere that we should just expect moving forward when it comes to the Senate approving Supreme Court nominees?
It appears that we've gotten to this point. And again, I don't want to be too cavalier about this, but it seems like the only appropriate Supreme Court justice to Republicans now is one that's nominated by a Republican and confirmed by a Republican Senate, that none others are legitimate or would count or would be permissible to work through the system. And yes, there is some history and yes, there's some tradition, but of course the Constitution creates no such conditions for the nomination of the court. And I don't know how we get out of this particular circumstance. Sort of the heightened partisanship probably started with Thurgood Marshall's nomination in the late 1960s, but then ramped up in the 1980s with the litmus test that was created by the Ronald Reagan administration for justices, and has only gotten worse in both Republican and Democratic administration, no matter whom holds the Senate in the majority. So this, unfortunately, I think for the near term, is our future when it comes to Supreme Court nominations.
Charlie Jacobs is a political science professor at St. Norbert College, and we are talking about the U.S. Supreme Court right now. And just today, the court ruled on a case involving the NCAA and compensation for student athletes. Let's get into this one, Charlie. What was at stake here?
So what was at stake was, in the minds of many, was amateurism in sport. Because the NCAA, which permits athletic scholarships at both the Division I and Division II levels, has argued that the scholarships are an appropriate compensation for student athletes, but anything beyond that is inappropriate because it erodes the foundation of amateurism and it allows corruption to creep into athletic departments around the country. And so they've resisted any kind of compensation. Student athletes have been arguing that they want a piece of the billion-dollar pie that is the NCAA and, in particular, Division I athletics. And in this particular case, the NCAA lost partially and the student athletes won partially. The court did not say that pay as an employee was necessary, but they did say that it was inappropriate to deny student athletes certain extra benefits beyond their scholarships, such as help with tutoring that's paid for by the school or computer hardware or software that might be provided for them. That won't be considered compensation that violates rules. And to do so would be a violation of U.S. antitrust laws. So, you know, the NCAA comes out with a bruised eye, but maybe not a black eye here. And I think there's something to celebrate for student athletes, but they haven't really won the pot of gold here.
Does this offer an opportunity in the future, though, or a little bit of hope for people who argue that student athletes at the collegiate level are playing high level sports and colleges make a lot of money off of them, so they should be reasonably compensated?
I think there is place to make that argument. Of course, there are a couple of confounding issues here, which will, you know, create real problems if this victory occurs for the student athletes. And I'm certainly not suggesting that they shouldn't aim for this, or even if they win, that it's, there's something inappropriate here. But, you know, it's going to create a larger arms race than already exists among larger schools in the United States. And those with great resources are going to benefit because they can pay student athletes while others will not. It's also going to increase the cost of athletics, and it's sort of going to change the dynamic of what they look like on college campuses. There are other issues such as Title IX, because you would have to make sure that you're compensating equally across women's and men's sports on campuses, and sort of more vertically among sort of the more premier sports, as well as the secondary and tertiary sports on campus. So there are a whole bunch of issues that opening up that Pandora's box would create. And you know, the student athletes are certainly looking out for their own interests, which they should be doing. But at the same time, it's a slippery slope once an award like this might be made, and the kind of impact it's going to have not only on college sports, but potentially on high school sports, because the same sort of arguments might also apply to independent governing bodies at the state level for high schoolers.
Hmm. We have just about a minute with you left, Charlie. What ruling do you still have your eye on in the coming days?
Oh, I'm not exactly sure. You know, the big blockbusters have sort of already come. I'm already looking to next year because, oh. You know, we've seen a tease about what might come and some of the arguments. In particular, what I'm looking for are the arguments about privacy and abortion coming next year. I think that's the one that everybody is sort of wondering exactly which direction the court will go. What we saw in the Fulton case here was compromise, a very, very narrow decision on a complex and controversial issue that's divided the court. One wonders if the same thing is going to happen with the abortion cases.
We will be following along. Charlie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Charlie Jacobs is a professor of political science at St. Norbert College, specializing in law and judicial process. He was with us to break down some of the rulings coming from the U.S. Supreme Court over the last few days and to talk about the politics that is inevitably woven into our conversations about the highest court in the land. Coming up after the news, we take some time to remember what those early days of the pandemic were like with the head of the Wisconsin Historical Society. And we want to hear your memories. You can call now at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. What do you remember from a year and a half ago and how far we've come, how things have changed? 800-642-1234. We'll get you in line to talk with you. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, more than 500 wells on French Island are contaminated with some level of PFAS. We've got the latest on the forever chemicals and how they've spread farther in the Wisconsin community than first thought. Join us on the Ideas Network tomorrow morning from 6 until 9. Now, with vaccinations up, mask mandates are ending, businesses are reopening, and for many Americans, life is starting to look like it did before the pandemic. As things start to feel more normal, we're taking this time to look back at the early days of the pandemic and hear your thoughts and your memories about what those days were like and how far we've come since then. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about the first weeks or the first months of the pandemic? What stands out to you? When did you realize how much this coronavirus was going to change day-to-day life? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Christian Overland is the director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society, and he's here to talk with us about it. Christian, thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Keeley. How are you?
Good, thank you. Let's start by listening to one of the first times we heard very specifically that life would be changing because of this virus. We've got Dr. Nancy Messonnier, a former public health official at the CDC, and here she is in February of 2020 giving some of those first warnings about canceling mass gatherings and closing schools down.
I understand this whole situation may seem overwhelming and that disruption to everyday life may be severe, but these are things that people need to start thinking about now. I had a conversation with my family over breakfast this morning, and I told my children that while I didn't think that they were at risk right now, we as a family need to be preparing for significant disruption of our lives.
That was from February of last year. We know that really about a week and a half into March, things really shut down across the U.S. Do you have a specific memory, a moment when you realized that life was starting to change, Christian?
Yes. I mean, at the Historical Society, we had a few meetings getting ready, actually talking to the state administration, the governor's office, the department administration about what was changing in society. And as you said, March 17th, all 50 states had COVID cases at that point in time. And I remember talking with a doctor, talking with me about, we only have so many respirators and ventilators in Dane County and in the state of Wisconsin. And that was a metric that I never really thought of about before. But they were concerned at that point in time about how many ventilators we had. And that's when it really dawned upon me that could this pandemic outpace the number of medical facilities that were available to heal people and treat people. So that was a pivotal moment for me, and I remember sharing that with the staff. Hmm.
And when did you get the sense that this was a moment the Wisconsin Historical Society needed to preserve in one way, that this was an even more obvious history in the moment?
So, of course, being the state agency of history for Wisconsin, we started looking at the 1918 pandemic right away and thinking about, is there an answer there? And one of our archivists, Jonathan Nelson, actually was pulling things out, and he noticed that there was a gap in the 1918 pandemic archive. Great resources we had in terms of what the state was doing, counties were doing, public commissions, health commissions, but the lack of everyday voice and the lack of the people's story coming through was the gap. And so he brought it to our attention, and we said, look, we need to do something about it. So it was April 2nd in 2020, when the world had a million cases that day, that we launched the COVID-19 Journaling Project.
And tell us a little bit about that.
So the idea was, you know, so looking at the idea of journaling, people having memories and what they were going through and writing those down, we were trying to collect those memories, if you will. And we had done that a couple of times in our history, one during the Civil War, sending out journals to volunteer troops that were going into war, into battle, and pencils along with them. And our director at that time, Lyman Draper, asked them to come back and deposit those journals in the Wisconsin State Historical Society. So we did that once. We did it also when the idea of the Peace Corps came about. The first 2 years, we sent journals out to people. They were volunteering for the Peace Corps, and we got those back. We also sent archivists out during the Civil Rights Movement, the Freedom of Summer in the 1960s. So we looked at that and said, this is probably the time to do it again. And we post things on our website. We ask people to sign up, and right away we got people interested in it.
We are talking with Christian Overland, who's the director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society. And we're remembering back to those beginning days of the COVID-19 pandemic and sharing our stories. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We've got Tom in Madison, who is reflecting. Hey, Tom.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, my life is multifaceted. I'm an actor, a musician. I'm also a professional sailor on the big schooner in Milwaukee. And it was really strange to watch my entire life just crash at the same time. My day jobs are singing with nursing home residents and schools and libraries. And my evening things ended with a play at the Bartell Theater in the middle of March. Plus, I also live with an emergency room nurse, and that's that was very scary as well. Has there been a time when something like this has been so politicized, though, I guess is my question.
Tom, thank you so much for sharing what you experienced when things really started to shut down. And Christian, what about the political climate of COVID-19? I suspect that we've had politics in a lot of the different conflicts and hard things that people in Wisconsin have experienced in the past.
Yes, I would say politics have always been a part of that. There's always different frameworks and different ideas that people bring to it and different experiences, too. So that has been a part of it. I think looking back in the 1918, one of the things to say to Tom about the politics of that, the way the state was running at that time, they were ahead of the game in the United States as far as public health commissions in every county and reporting up to the state. So our ability to respond was fast and swift. However, the idea about keeping schools open, that was being debated, and shutting schools down was an issue, too. So there are some correlations that, you know, Tom brings up, and it does happen because you're affecting in a pandemic affects people's personal lives. And so this is the impact that we all felt in the past year in a number of months. And now coming out of it, we're documenting that by actually collecting the memories of people, such as people like Tom. And I encourage Tom to actually send us his thoughts.
And how do we do that?
So if people went to the wisconsinhistory.org, that is our website, they will be able to see our COVID-19 journal project. And you just click on it, and basically it tells you how to do it. Right away you can sign up. It's really easy. It gives you a number of prompts, what to write about if you're thinking about how do we actually put something together. We collect everything, too. It's not just a pencil and paper journal. We collect video journals. We collect art journals. Anything you can imagine that people leave their memory on and their impressions and their feelings, we have collected that. And so it's pretty easy. We're still collecting these journals, too. People are signing up every day.
And we've got a link for that at WPR.org/Central Time. So that's another option. Tom, thanks so much for the call at 800-642-1234. You can join in, too, just like Tom, and let us know what you experienced at the early days of the pandemic. And Christian, the other things Tom talked about, so many facets of life just suddenly being gone all at the same time. Are those the concepts that are showing up in the submissions?
They are. We have submissions from, like, the youngest one is a 14-year-old talking about the loss of sports, to college students and high school seniors talking about the loss of graduation and the loss of prom or the loss of being able to see their friends. And then the impact going into September of 2020, the changes that hit with school again coming back in. So the type of things that we're seeing, you know, relate to from everyday situations, people coming together with families coming in together, isolation issues, but also people talking about what they're doing and how they're getting by. And that's the fascinating piece.
Let's talk more of that in just a moment. We're talking with Christian Overland, the head of the Wisconsin Historical Society. We're reflecting on those early days of the pandemic, what life was like. And we're talking about how history will remember this time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When did you realize things were starting to change? Do you remember the first time you wore a face mask in public? Did you cancel a birthday party or a gathering? What was that time like for you, and when did everything kind of set in? Give us a call now. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. This conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking some time to share our memories of the first weeks and months of the pandemic. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Christian Overland is with us. He's the director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society. And you can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Share the memories that stand out to you, the things you want to share. Christian, how have these journal entries changed throughout the pandemic?
Well, that's a great question, Keeley. The beginning of it, starting in April, we asked people to write in 30 to 60 to 90 day increments because, I mean, I think the rest of the world was thinking about this would be over sooner than it was. People were first starting to talk about what was going on in their daily life, the type of things that they were seeing, such as how many times they would go to the grocery store, the changes in the grocery store. We were talked about masks earlier in the segment. People talked about the first time they could actually get a mask as well. And then going forward into the next couple of weeks and months, people actually started talking about what it was like experiencing the pandemic through their community. So we had one shopkeeper, for instance, in central Wisconsin, who ran a shop, and he was talking about people coming in that were masked or unmasked and what that was like and his reaction to it and other people's reactions to each other. So what we're seeing is a real change in what has happened to people and how they reacted to it emotionally as well as intellectually. And people actually were getting a sense that they know that they're leaving their story for history, and they're writing about it and trying to be very purposeful about that too.
You can sense that in the responses, that they understand the gravity of this.
Yes. There are some people, talking about not sure what's going to be happening. Some of the younger college-bound students not sharing if they're going to go to college, not sharing what's going to be happening with that in terms of what's going to happen the next few months. Again, we're talking about the spring of 2020 at this point. But then moving into it, people started to document what was available for buying and what was not available. We have this one journal where the person just put in receipts every day if they went out and what they were looking for and what they couldn't get. We have a journal of someone who wrote down everything that they ate and kind of the recipes. There was one really nice phrase, some gumbling tonight, which is like a tomato dish with sausage and in it. And they said, no tater tot casserole for me tonight. So you get that kind of humor, too.
Right. Real life there woven in. We've got Lisa in Beaver Dam who wants to share their story. Hey, Lisa.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thanks. What are you thinking about?
Well, it was about the second week of March, and I was driving for Uber, just part-time. And I wanted to get out and about and see what was going on, and I got a call to the Baptist College in Watertown. And it's a high school. And I picked up a young couple, and one of the kids lived in Canada. So it sounded like that, just that day they were told, get your stuff, we're closing, goodbye. I ended up taking them to Delavan to a hotel. I think they were meeting up with some other people. But just the thought of trying to get over the border to get home to Canada, it felt creepy, like something out of a sci-fi movie, or one of these pandemic movies. So that I just wanted to share that, that feeling was just spooky.
Hmm. And overhearing it, Lisa, that it was not just a something you were talking about, but something you got in on with other people.
Right. Huh. Yeah, it was very, uncertain times, that's for sure. I'll never forget those kids. I felt so bad for them. I don't know if they made it home.
Lisa, yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. And, Lisa mentions the uncertainty and really not knowing where other people's stories have necessarily ended, Christian.
Right. And, what we're finding out now, too, through the journal project is that people sent journals to us like in December, January, February. Now people are starting, some of those people, it's a phenomenon actually happening where they're rewriting their journals, talking about what they're going through today. And what your caller was talking about earlier, we have one journal that was from someone in Madison who was going to school, and they had to leave, and they had to go to Italy. And so they kept their journal going. They were here as a international student, and they kept their journal going, and they wrote what it was like to be in Italy at the time they left, which was in May. And it's fascinating, what people are writing about. I think the other thing that we also look at those early days is the numbers. You're talking about emotion through reading, right? People counting the numbers in their journals and wondering what's going to happen to the Midwest when New York is becoming the epicenter or Italy is becoming, the world epicenter. Is this going to happen to us? And so there's actually fear in some of these words. And concern, for their loved ones in other parts of the United States, they just can't get to at that point of time.
Christian Overland is the director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society, and we're talking about our memories from the beginning of the pandemic and also about the COVID-19 journaling project through the Historical Society. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. We've got Jamie in Algoma on the line. Hey, Jamie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to report that I feel really out of sync with what everybody else is going through. At the beginning of the pandemic, my place of employment shut down for 6 weeks. We were covered by PPP, thankfully. But then I went back to work in the dental lab, and my boyfriend worked at the hospital. So we both worked through it, and I was around other masked people, so I felt pretty comfortable. Well, the beginning of this month, the place where I worked dropped their mask mandate, whether or not you were vaccinated. And I'm taking an immunosuppressant. I did get vaccinated, but I found out that my body isn't producing antibodies, so I'm pretty much unprotected. And so I decided I couldn't work around unmasked, unvaccinated people, which I would have had to do, so I just quit my job. So now I'm I'm learning what it felt like for all the people who lost their jobs during the beginning of the pandemic. I'm just now going through that.
And Jamie, what do you mean more with that out of sync? Just that you're kind of on a different timeline because of the losses you're experiencing?
Right, because so many people experienced that loss early on, and I was employed all through the beginning of the pandemic and didn't really feel that affected by it. And now it's hitting me because I'm unemployed, and it seems everybody else is lifting and they're going back to normal, and now I'm in lockdown kind of by myself.
Jamie, we really appreciate your willingness to share that experience and talk about what you've gone through in this pandemic. And Christian, people had very different experiences during the pandemic and even now.
They did. And you're correct. And it's still going on. What Jamie was talking about as far as working in healthcare, one of the things that we did is we created something called the COVID-19 poster project that actually used some of the old Uncle Sam type of poster imagery. And we worked with artists in Wisconsin to create ways to communicate. And we posted some of these up in the hospitals too, recognizing that there was a whole group of people that were protecting us, the first responders, people in the hospitals through that time. And that's fascinating to get some of those stories. And to Jamie's point, a lot of those people didn't have time to start the journaling project. We're just starting to get a few of those people in now. So if there's an opportunity for listeners that have worked in healthcare and they wanted to leave their story, please go to wisconsinhistory.org. We're interested in collecting your story too, because it did happen on different timelines. And what the first response was as far as in history compared to what it was in 1918 is incredibly powerful for historians in the future to know about.
What about this idea of collective memory and how we as a big group of people think about big historical events?
Well, it's an important part of the concept of history, right? That people actually have these collective memories. And one of the biggest ones in the United States right now with the close of the 20th century was the American Civil War. Most people can relate to that in some way as far as a collective memory and understanding what it went through. Yes, there's different stories. Yes, there's in-depth stories and there's different frameworks, but it's something that's in the American consciousness. The pandemic is certainly going to be that. And when we think about the power of the collective memory in it, it's what are those tools that we need to understand that, the different stories. And the idea that people can tell the stories of their nation from themselves, and that is an important part of history that will be preserved forever, is a powerful idea, first of all, for one, giving people voices, not from just the present, but they're giving them a voice to the future, too. And it's also going to be a powerful idea for the future to look back and see how people did this. Like I said earlier in the segment, the Historical Society did not have these type of collections. It does not have these type of collections for the 1918 pandemic. So today, we'll be able to give a gift to the future by giving people a voice.
Christian, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this project.
You're welcome.
That was Christian Overland. He's the director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society. He was with us today to remember what those early days of the pandemic were like as things start to slowly return to normal, hopefully toward the end of this pandemic, and to share your story with the Historical Society's COVID-19 journaling project. Visit our website. It's WPR.org/Central Time. Wisconsin's Nate Carroll is likely a world record holder. Technically, the Guinness Book of World Records is reviewing his effort. Last June, Carroll decided to break the world record for the most push-ups done in 1 year. He's 45 years old, works as a social worker in Winneconne. He did push-ups throughout the day, all the time, whether he was taking care of his kids or working or really anything else. Carroll recorded his push-ups and posted videos to carry people along on his journey. He averaged more than 4,100 push-ups every day. Carroll seems to have broken a record that was set back in 1989 when he logged his 1,500,231st push-up earlier this month. Carroll aimed for that world record, and he also raised money for the Tunnels to Towers Foundation that helps families of first responders who died while doing their work. Congratulations, Nate Carroll. We'll keep our eyes out for an official ruling on that push-up world record. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.